We will now turn our attention to our first case of the day, United States v. Day. In doing so, I note that Senior Judge Efron has graciously agreed to participate in our oral arguments during the next 2 days and is seated here on the bench in light of the ongoing vacancy on our court. Major Blythe, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Major Christie, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Efron, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Major Matthew Blythe, and together with my co-counsel, Mr. Mark Brueger, we represent the appellant in this case, Airman First Class Caitlin Day. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Airman Day stands convicted of two specifications of attempted conspiracy, a creature unknown to federal criminal law. Attempted conspiracy raises no unique concerns under the UCMJ, and yet military law diverges from federal practice in allowing this type of inchoate offense stacking. This court should follow the well-established interpretation of a similar federal statute on the same point and harmonize the UCMJ with federal practice. In short, this court should hold attempted conspiracy is not an offense under the UCMJ.
Now, counsel, in your brief, you make a number of good arguments in terms of the confusing nature of double inchoate offense, that solicitation is an issue that's out there now, that perhaps the drafters intended that to be the approach to take, that federal civilian courts go in the other direction. But in terms of it being unwise or disfavored, that seems to be a different issue than whether it is in fact prohibited, the government was prohibited from charging it. Is that an unfair standard for this court to place on you? And if so, why? And if not, where in your briefs and in your argument today can you show us that the government was prohibited from charging it in this manner?
Yes, sir. And our position is not merely that it is unwise to charge attempted conspiracy, it's that it's not a viable offense. And the legal landscape differs from when this court decided Riddle in 1996 or Valagura in 2000 or Ressler in 2001. The establishment of the solicitation statute removed one of the key rationales in Riddle that, you know, but for the analysis might have differed in 1996 at that point. In addition to that, when Valagura embraced the federal approach to conspiracy with the bilateral approach to conspiracy, it, in emphatic language, said that the interpretation of UCMJ should follow the well-established federal practice on a similar substantive criminal statute. And I think that's where we are today. We have a solicitation statute to capture the misconduct, and now, in sync with federal practice, this court should follow suit and hold that attempted conspiracy is not an offense. And it goes back to the origins of conspiracy. Commentators and jurists have long stated that conspiracy is vague, it's amorphous, it's expands to the limits of its logic. And with attempted conspiracy, something unknown to federal law, it's moved beyond the limits of its logic.
But the rejoinder, I assume, by the government would be, you've kind of hit the nail on the head in terms of it should be done this way. But is there anything mandating that the government not do it this way? As of the current state of the law or the state of the law at the time that this occurred in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think it goes back to the inconsistency of attempted conspiracy into the UCMJ and established federal practice that has never blessed attempted conspiracy as a solution to the same problem. And this would be resolving and harmonizing an inconsistency there. It's not as though the plain language of the statute, when interpreting a substantive criminal statute like this, sometimes it yields to other doctrines related to those offenses. So a common example is with mens rea. Congress may not explicitly state a mens rea, but courts are loath to read a strict liability offense. They'll read into the statute, even absent the plain language, that there is a requisite mental state to separate innocent conduct from unlawful conduct. And we see the same thing at work even within the conspiracy statute here, where this court has taken substantive doctrines that are developed both in this court and also in Article III courts and applied them to conspiracy. So one example would be the statute says any person subject to the chapter who conspires with any other person. Any other person suggests that law enforcement would be included. But in the Valagura case, this court looked at federal practice and the interpretation of conspired and determined that no, you cannot conspire with a law enforcement agent. Another example where, against the plain text, the doctrine goes the other way is with Wharton's rule, for instance. Under the conspiracy statute, it specifically says an offense under the chapter. That would presumably be any offense under the chapter, under the government's argument. And yet Wharton's rule, which covers offenses which by their very nature require more than one person to complete, those are not chargeable as conspiracy. And so contrary to the plain language of the conspiracy statute, we have a supporting doctrine of conspiracy inhibiting the government from charging it there. So we would say it's kind of in the same vein where the established doctrine of conspiracy, well established in the federal law, does not permit the stacking of inchoate offenses, attempt and conspiracy to create this novel offense here.
Counsel, these are persuasive arguments if we were writing on a clean slate. Right? This was 1996 and we were doing this all over again. I think you'd be in a lot better position. But look, what do we do with Riddle? And how do your arguments play into the traditional factors for stare decisis?
Well, Your Honor, with Riddle, I think I alluded to before, I think that the legal landscape has changed a bit. One of the, you know, there are three rationales in Riddle for why attempted conspiracy could be an offense. One is the broad language of Article 80 and Article 81, but I addressed a bit before on why that doesn't necessarily carry the day. There's no affirmative bar by statute or case law. And then the third is, if there is, because at that time the court had not yet embraced the unilateral bilateral approach, and there was no solicitation statute, there was a way that this conduct could conceivably escape prosecution. And so with the establishment of the solicitation statute, I don't know if it's quite saying it's superseded by statute, but it is undercutting a key rationale in Riddle. So Riddle's logic, that third prong of it, kind of relies on the notion that if we don't do this, we're going to be allowing some kind of misconduct to escape.
And, I think the word you use in your brief is undermines, and I think that captures perfectly what has happened since 1996 has undermined the logic of Riddle. But is that enough under the traditional factors of stare decisis? I mean, has this proven to be unworkable? Are there other factors that might be in play here that would support this court overturning Riddle?
Well, Your Honor, in terms of workability, there have not been a plethora of cases charging attempted conspiracy, but a number of them have worked their way up to this court because of the difficulty of the offense of attempted conspiracy. There's not a significant reliance interest at play here because, in part, the solicitation statute captures the problem that may have existed before, so there's no longer the same reliance interest. We need attempted conspiracy to capture the misconduct. And then our argument is that the solicitation statute, kind of the law has advanced past the basis at the time Riddle was decided. So I think the stare decisis factors would militate in favor of overturning it. And in a way, Riddle's language kind of foresaw what the steps would be required in order to make it no longer necessary, and that is either embracing a unilateral approach or, as has happened, the creation of a solicitation statute.
In Riddle, is the existence or non-existence of a solicitation statute a key principle, or is it a required principle, or is it simply a leg upon which they stood, but they could stand on other legs as well? That is, does the solicitation language in Riddle constitute an essential element of a decision which starts by focusing on the text of the statute dealing with attempts?
Yes, sir. And I think my reading of Riddle is that it is indispensable to the analysis because the analysis would be different but for that prong. I think all three of the prongs were required, all three of the points that Riddle made were necessary for the holding to be supported. And so I think the language that it used, both in the text where it said it's where it's particularly appropriate where there's no solicitation statute or unilateral, and then in the footnote where it also said, a point of the commentary that it's unnecessary in situations where there's a solicitation statute or a unilateral approach. So I think that, to answer your question directly, I think that Riddle doesn't stand without that third part of the analysis.
So what part of
Article 80B, which prohibits, quote, attempts to commit any offense punishable by this chapter, requires anything else than the text of that statute to permit an attempt to be charged against any of the offenses under the UCMJ, just looking at the text.
Yes, Your Honor, and I mentioned before, I think a rejoinder to that would be looking at the conspiracy statute where this court has done exactly that, looked beyond an offense to bar the prosecution of certain offenses because of the supporting doctrines surrounding conspiracy. So I think we'd be asking this court to apply the same logic that we have an established federal principle where attempted conspiracy is not viable, and that the combination of those statutes, even though it is against the language, as you say, any offense, Your Honor, it still would not be chargeable against the backdrop of federal practice.
Is there something in the Constitution that would require us to do that?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe there is.
Major Blythe, good morning.
Good morning.
You've used the term should several times in your discussion with the Chief Judge earlier. I think your position, and correct me if I'm wrong, in your brief is that this isn't a should not be an offense situation. This is a, according to you, this can't be an offense. It is not an offense. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor. I'm just loath to tell this court what it must do. So that's why I phrase it as should.
Well, you're a major in Air Force. In any event, my question is, if in fact we are in the world of should or should not be an offense, you would agree that we're the wrong audience to hear that argument, would you not?
Yes, Your Honor. If we're incorrect that attempted conspiracy is a non-offense, then it's for Congress to solve that. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The granted issue in this case addresses federal law, and you've mentioned that the offense of attempted conspiracy has been not used, at least not used widely, in the federal prosecutions. And although the issue addresses federal law, neither party has quoted Title 18 or any other part of the Federal Criminal Code here. Is there any federal statute comparable to Article 80B that would prohibit or permit or otherwise address attempted conspiracy in the text of the federal statute?
Your Honor, the only analog I can really point to is where Congress has decided to modify the offense of conspiracy to do something close to attempted conspiracy. It's not even that close, but for drug conspiracies, there's no requirement of an overt act, and that's under 21 U.S.C. 846. And when Congress has decided to modify the offense of conspiracy to shear off an element of it from the traditional understanding, it's in a separate statute explicitly stated. And so when Congress has chosen to do something akin to attempted conspiracy, it has done so through a separate statute like that and not through the inchoate offense stacking with all of the doctrinal problems that generates.
Is your answer one of we need to look at a variety of different laws as opposed to looking at any text in Title 18 that would either permit or prohibit an attempted conspiracy being charged?
If I understand your question, Your Honor, if there is one in Title 18 that
right. No, the argument is that federal law doesn't recognize this, and I'm looking to see if there is a Title 18 or other U.S. Code provision that would emulate the text of Article 80B, which talks about attempting to commit any offense under this chapter. Is there anything in Title 18 that would permit or prohibit the use of an attempt to charge an attempted conspiracy?
I'm not familiar with, Your Honor, and the government hasn't pointed one out either. I apologize.
Thank you.
Going back to the basics of conspiracy, one of the problems we have here is it's difficult for lawyer, let alone any layperson, to understand the intersection of attempt and conspiracy. And Judge Cox explained it well in his dissent in Riddle, that attempt is after conspiracy in the order of inchoate offenses, and yet it jumps before, and it's uncertain how that plays out with the intersection of a substantial step and an overt act. And the military, this case perfectly illustrates the problems that flow from that. Here, with the attempted conspiracy with TL, the problem is the military judge, the only element that was left was an agreement. And so what we have here is an attempted conspiracy where the only thing we have, there's no overt act, there's only an agreement. And so you've modified the scope of the conspiracy offense with TL by virtue of creating the attempted conspiracy.
Okay, so after they threw out the purchasing of the substance they thought was fentanyl, wasn't it the case that the overt act or the attempted overt act was the communications about how they were going to make payment and when they were going to meet? I mean, it wasn't just that they had the agreement, but it was also that they then proceeded to negotiate about payment and times that they were going to meet. Does that count for nothing?
Well, Your Honor, I think the charged overt act was the agreement. There were other acts that could have been charged, a phone call, a missed phone call. I'm not agreeing that that would have been sufficient, but a missed phone call or the setting up of a payment system, those are possible overt acts.
Wasn't that in the charge? And they accepted the attempted purchase of fentanyl, but not the other language.
That's right. I see my time has expired.
Please proceed.
I think that the language of the specification is essentially that she did agree with TL to pay him for lessons for the poisoning lessons, essentially. And I think that the problem is with
normal. And then it said, and to further the object of this conspiracy, and then they listed the two things, which is negotiating or attempting to arrange payment and so forth, and the fentanyl. They struck only the fentanyl language.
I'll have to double-check the specification, but I believe that what was left after he struck the language was the agreement to pay for lessons. And I think that that's inseparable from the overt act in a normal conspiracy is supposed to be separate from the required steps to complete the agreement. And so the position would be that it wouldn't suffice as an overt act in a normal conspiracy doctrine.
Any additional questions from the bench? Thank you. Major Christie.
Chief Judge Olson, and may it please the court, I'm Major Morgan Christie, and along with Major Allison Gish, I represent the United States. The plain language of RCM 907 is unmistakable. Failure to state an offense is a waivable motion. And the plain language of Article 80 is unmistakable. Attempted conspiracy is a crime. Appellant urges this court to bypass the plain language of both and find she pleaded guilty to a non-existent crime. This court should reject that invitation for two reasons. First, because the military judge's misstatement of the law didn't resurrect a claim that was waived by operation of law. And second, the broad language of Article 80 plainly allows for an attempted conspiracy charge. Appellant waived this issue.
So let's get into the waiver issue a little bit.
Yes, Your Honor.
Obviously, this court has placed great emphasis on the importance of a military judge walking an accused through the plea. Why shouldn't it strike us as quite odd that the government then would say that an instance such as this, where the military judge very clearly misstates the law, that, in fact, we should ignore that fact?
Well, Your Honor, we should not ignore it. Certainly what the judge said was wrong. It was error. But what we also shouldn't ignore is the appellant's repeated affirmations of her understanding, both orally and in writing. Because while the military judge certainly shoulders primary responsibility for assuring that a guilty plea is knowing and voluntary, he doesn't do so in a vacuum. That error in what he said has to be viewed in the context of the entire record. And appellant's repeated affirmations demonstrate that there was a clear, shared understanding between appellant and the convening authority.
Now, when you say repeated affirmations, what are you referring to there?
Your Honor, I'm referring to the plain language of the plea agreement where she
says... But the military judge is required to explain what that means. So how can that initial written material trump what the military judge later states is the actual applicable law, even though he was mistaken? Why isn't it, to give a homey example, why isn't it a situation where somebody's watching an infomercial on TV and they're being told if you send in 1999, you're going to get this product, and the viewer is all in, and then the announcer says, but wait, there's more. Here the military judge was saying to this accused, you understand what this agreement is, but wait, there's more. You cannot waive this. Military judge was wrong, but why didn't the accused have the right to rely upon that misstatement of the law by the military judge?
Your Honor, the distinction with the infomercial is in the infomercial, the consumer hadn't yet paid the $19.99. In this instance,
a plea agreement does not become effective until the military judge has gone through everything and it's a done deal.
True, Your Honor. The military judge had not yet accepted the plea agreement, but appellant had already pleaded guilty. And even now on appeal, appellant has never said that the military judge's statement affected her decision to plead guilty because she had pleaded guilty a day before.
Okay, let's jump back a little bit, though. If this was so, if there was such a solid understanding on the part of the accused about what this meant in terms of, gee, I could have waived this, even though the military judge is telling me to the contrary. If the defense counsel was so effective at explaining that to the accused, his or her counsel, then why didn't the counsel jump up when the military judge misstated the law and say, Your Honor, wait a minute?
Well, Your Honor, the defense counsel had no obligation to do that. If the defense counsel, its primary responsibility is to zealously represent the interests of their client, then they had absolutely no incentive to do that because then...
So the defense counsel should sandbag the court on this?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it's sandbagging. I think what it is we have to look at the totality of the circumstances and say that a military judge's singular sentence, although wrong, doesn't trump the correct advice of competent counsel. Because appellant had two defense counsel, one of whom was a senior defense counsel, who fully advised her on the meaning, effect, and consequences of her plea and the terms of the plea agreement. And those two defense counsel competency she did not question at trial and does not challenge now on appeal. Two defense counsel who enjoy a strong presumption of competency under Strickland, and these two defense counsel never contemplated filing a motion to dismiss. And the two defense counsel didn't file that motion even after the military judge misstated the law because they knew it wasn't the current state of the law. And appellant knew this too, because in her plea agreement, she agreed to waive all motions that are waivable under current legal precedent. At the time, failure to state an offense was waivable. So she spelled out six rights she wasn't waiving. Failure to state an offense wasn't one of them. And those six rights she specifically enumerated track rights that aren't waivable under RCM 705.
So this accused should have been a better lawyer than the military judge?
No, Your Honor.
Well, that seems to be what you're saying in terms of waive all waivable motions, lists all these things, should have known the applicable state of the law, military judge says something to the contrary, and somehow this accused is supposed to know, gee, this military judge got this wrong.
Your Honor, the accused is supposed to rely on the advice of her defense counsel, who are presumed to be competent, who advised her on the current state of the law.
So and the advice of the defense counsel is the military judge's statement of law is subordinate to what defense counsel says?
No, Your Honor. But when we look at all the different factors that support the appellant's understanding, it's clear that that's the answer. So to take appellant's argument to its logical conclusion, she would have to have been correctly advised by defense counsel that she was giving up this motion. Then the military judge says, wait a second, you can't waive it. And then the appellant thinks, okay, well, I can't waive it. If that's the case, then nothing stopped her from bringing that motion. She had up until adjournment to bring a motion to dismiss for failure to state an offense. The fact that she didn't raise it, even after the military judge made this misstatement, shows she did not believe that she was preserving it for appeal. And not every misstatement mandates relief. Appellant cites no law in support of her argument that the military judge somehow revived an issue that by operation of law was waived. A military judge doesn't have the power to alchemize a non-jurisdictional claim into a jurisdictional one by his words. And his words alone don't reanimate a waive all waivable motions provision in a plea agreement.
Counsel, I have a more fundamental jurisdictional question. I understand the government's position that even if this was not an offense, that it was still waived because that is not a jurisdictional defect. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
How does that square with Article 18? Because if she was charged and convicted of something that was not an offense, how did the court-martial have jurisdiction? How did the general court-martial have jurisdiction in the first place?
Well, Your Honor, it depends on it goes to how jurisdiction exists, not only subject matter jurisdiction or personal jurisdiction, because the distinction is appellant is not raising a constitutional challenge to the statute. Certainly, the waiver doctrine is not without limits. This court recognized that in Bradley and the Supreme Court in Class as well.
But what is the theory, what is the government's theory that the general court-martial had jurisdiction to charge some? Is it that they had jurisdiction, or just that that's not a jurisdiction? The lack of jurisdiction is not a jurisdictional defect.
Your Honor, it's both. The military court-martial did have jurisdiction to try this accused.
Even if she was charged with something that wasn't an offense under the code.
Your Honor, yes, Your Honor. I think the distinction is jurisdiction to try a court member to a military member is distinct from whether or not that offense fails to state an offense.
Why?
Because in this case, Your Honor, it's not like the appellant was charged with a purely invented, made-up crime.
What's the difference? I mean, it's an offense or it's not, right? If we decide it's not an offense, then it wasn't an offense.
Sure, so it has to be an offense under the code. So Article 80 is obviously an offense under the code. If she was charged with a made-up offense like jaywalking in violation of Article 200 of the UCMJ, that would not be an offense.
So Congress can put an unconstitutional offense in the code, and that would create jurisdiction?
No, Your Honor. Certainly this court has the authority to review constitutional claims and police Congress's authority to pass crimes. And that distinction is important because appellant is not raising any form of constitutional challenge. She has not once argued that the statutory scheme is facially unconstitutional, nor that it's unconstitutional as applied, or even that the plain language produces absurd results. So Article 80 is certainly a crime under the plain language of the UCMJ. And the Supreme Court has long held that when a statute's language is plain, the sole function of the court is to enforce it according to its terms.
Congress can also strip this court and court-martials in general of jurisdiction over certain things. And I think the appellant is arguing that's exactly what happened here. They have court-martials, and we and the CCAs have no jurisdiction to hear cases where there are offenses charged that aren't offenses under the code. And they said this is not an offense, right? We don't need to think of a fanciful example. I mean, sometimes Congress likes to make it very hard to understand exactly when the effective dates are for certain changes to the code. We can have an offense charge that was an offense, then isn't an offense anymore. I mean, this is not a fanciful thing. Wouldn't that strip the court-martial of jurisdiction?
Well, Your Honor, I think that is respectfully too narrow of a reading because we look at why, for instance, this came about, and we look at the Supreme Court precedent in Cotton and Lamar and look at whether a defective indictment strips a federal court of their jurisdiction. And the Supreme Court has long held that it does not. And so the precedent in implementing...
Well, I mean, do you recognize the difference between a defective indictment of an actual offense and a charge of something that's not an offense at all?
Yes, Your Honor. And here, this is certainly an offense because when you look to the four corners of the charge sheet, the charge contained every element of an Article 80 offense and every element of Article 81 dealing with a conspiracy. So when we look at the four corners, that is a charge that should end the court's analysis barring a constitutional argument, which appellant does not make. But appellant urges this court to move beyond the plain letter of the law and find that it's not an offense. But appellant was not charged with a made-up offense, and the charge sheet contained all of the elements. And so if appellant is not attacking the statute as being unconstitutional, then we should defer to Congress, who has wide discretion in deciding what's a crime, especially for federal crimes, which are only a creature of statute. The policy arguments appellant advances are best left to the legislature rather than through ad hoc judicial determinations that contravene legislative intent. To quote this court in McPherson, the court is not empowered to ignore the plain language of a statute merely because the statute is unwise, illogical, or even harmful. That power lies with Congress.
Do you think this is the government's position, that this is unwise and illogical, this particular offense?
No, Your Honor.
You don't think this is unwise?
Not based on these facts, Your Honor, because even though the government could have charged one of the specifications under solicitation, the government has wide discretion in choosing its charging scheme. It also could not have charged solicitation for the other specification. And when we look at why we would, for policy, want to criminalize this, a rational Congress certainly could have intended to criminalize a military member paying for kill lessons on how to poison a human to death and then paying for a lethal drug to do the poisoning with. The very act of this appellant attempting to form a criminal conspiracy crystallized her purpose to kill. Once she had the feigned support of JM through the fentanyl buy and then her kill lessons from TL in place, she was resolute. She told JM she for sure was going through with murdering her husband. So in this case, criminalizing an attempted conspiracy served a valid preventative purpose. And the mental gymnastics that appellant cites about a nonsensical crime, they're nothing new. The first conspiracy law originated under the reign of King Edward I in 1305, and quite frankly, it's been confusing scholars ever since.
I wasn't around then.
Me neither, Your Honor. And I also don't think I was around when Justice Cardozo in 1932 said that this history of conspiracy exemplifies the tendency of a principle to expand itself to the limits of its logic. Any conspiracy charge certainly has the potential to be cumbersome and confusing.
But counsel, on that point, appellant argues that the whole concept is very difficult. What exactly are the elements of attempted conspiracy? You know, when I look at the Providence inquiry, especially with the one with TL, it sounded like they were just going through the elements of conspiracy as opposed to attempted conspiracy. What are the elements of attempted conspiracy? If we had to put it in opinion, what would we say?
Your Honor, we would have to include all the elements of attempt and all of the elements of conspiracy. So when we're looking specifically to the actus reus for the attempt, the appellant had to have taken an overt act in furtherance of that conspiracy, which is what she plainly stated she did during the Providence inquiry. And also, we can look to all reasonable inferences drawn out from the appellant's Providence inquiry with the judge to show that she, in her own words, was not just admitting the underlying facts. She was admitting substantively that she was guilty of an Article 80. She put that language in her plea agreement, and she admitted to all of the elements and did not have any issue with understanding each element. So I think when you look at the elements, certainly it can become cumbersome because the government's burden of proof, if this were a contested case, is not lessened at all because they stack two inchoate offenses. At some point, it is theoretically possible that if you have a triple or a quadruple inchoate offense.
Let me ask about that. Would they have to prove that there was actually a concluded agreement for attempted conspiracy? And would the government have to prove that there was an actual substantial step? Or wouldn't, I mean, overt act? You say that they have to prove all the elements, but I thought with attempt, you don't actually have to prove all the elements. You just have to show a substantial step towards them. So, as I said, when you looked at the Providence inquiry, they looked to see whether there was an agreement, whether there was an overt act. But I'm just trying to understand what it means to have an attempted conspiracy.
Sure, Your Honor. I think we look to the actus reus first of the attempt, which is a substantial step. The actus reus, obviously, of the conspiracy is that there is a criminal agreement. But in this case, because the military jurisdiction has adopted a bilateral theory of conspiracy, there cannot actually be an agreement. So anytime there's just a feigned agreement under a conspiracy, the overt act, the actus reus for the attempt, is the substantial step. Meaning, if the facts were as appellant believed they were, she would have been able to form that conspiracy, but for the impossibility that that JM was acting as an undercover law enforcement agent or informant, and that TL, she was not actually there was no agreement because they didn't actually follow through with the three phone calls to learn how to kill a person.
Counsel, appellant argues that the attempted conspiracy is something that is either not done at all or at least strongly disfavored in the civilian courts. Does the government agree with that position?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is there some military necessity involved here that supports the use of attempted conspiracy in the military?
No, Your Honor. Nor does there need to be one, because it's not an Article 134 offense. We're not dealing with terminal elements. We're not taking military jurisdiction back to the point that there needed to be some sort of military-specific nexus. This Congress could have rationally intended to prohibit this, and there's no requirement that Congress make a military's punitive articles mirror civilian penal codes. After all, the military is a specialized society from civilian society. We have plenty of crimes that are unique to the military. And although 18 U.S.C. 1349, which is the attempt and conspiracy statute, does include similar broad language to that in Article 80, that any person who attempts or conspires to commit any offense under this chapter shall be subject to the same penalties. Even though that is similar language, when we look at synchronizing military law with federal practice under Article 36, this court in Valagora said, to the extent practicable, a criminal trial should resemble a trial in federal district court, so long as it's not inconsistent with the UCMJ.
Counsel, does Section 1349 apply to the entirety of Title 18, or does it just apply to one chapter within Title 18?
It just applies to one chapter, Your Honor. And the distinction with that is that under Article 80, it is broader and says any offense under the code. And certainly Article 82, conspiracy, is an offense under the code.
Counsel, Articles 80, 81, and 82, they can't be charged standing alone, right? That's why they're inchoate offenses. They have to be charged in reference to some other offense, right?
Your Honor, I see I've run out of time. May I answer?
Please proceed.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why doesn't that matter? Like, why doesn't it? Are they real offenses under the code if they can't be charged standing alone?
They're absolutely real offenses, Your Honor. Yes, the President has specifically enumerated seven attempt type offenses that should be charged outside of Article 80. But the reason for that is that you can't have an attempt to commit a crime that, in its very nature, is an attempt. And that's why the President has excised out seven crimes that should be charged under a different chapter. So provided it's not an attempt to attempt a crime that is an attempt, you can certainly charge any crime under Article 80.
Well, if the President needed to step in and clarify that, doesn't that sort of undermine your argument that the text of Articles 80, 81, and 82 is dispositive? Right? Because your argument is it just says offense. It doesn't make any difference between any of the offenses under the code, and we shouldn't look any farther than that. But if the President had to come in and clarify that you can't attempt to attempt, doesn't that sort of undermine your argument that the text is dispositive?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. First, although the discussion section is non-binding, it certainly helps show the President's intent. There are multiple sections of the code and also in the analysis and discussion sections where both the President and Congress have clarified court holdings or recent holdings and said this is why we are adding this additional text. Certainly the court has to look to substantive military law in conjunction with Article 80, but the reason you can't have an attempt to attempt is grounded in constitutional principles. And so if it's grounded in constitutional principles, at some point the actus reus is too far removed from the mens rea, and so the Supreme Court has held that's why we don't prosecute thought offenses.
Any further questions from the bench? Senior Judge Efron.
To go hopefully quickly back to the earlier dialogue on waiver, the military judge did say that a motion that was not waivable was failure to state an offense. That's on page 187 of the joint appendix. Is there any place in the record, in the plea agreement or otherwise, in which the accused affirmatively said that failure to state an offense was waived? Was there anything where those words were specifically noted in the record other than in this one place?
Those express words, no, Your Honor.
So is there a requirement with this type of waiver that it be a voluntary and knowing and intelligent waiver?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if the military judge states that a particular matter is waivable and it is not otherwise discussed in any of the documents, what would be the argument for saying that's a knowing and intelligent waiver?
The argument, Your Honor, would be that's different than if something is impliedly stated, both in the plea agreement by enumerating the six rights that she was not waiving. You can infer from that 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 did not include failure to state an offense. And you can also infer that if her defense counsel are competent, which they are, that she was instructed on the current state of the law, and the current state of the law was that it was waivable, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Any further questions from the bench? Thank you. Major Blatt.
Your Honor, I wanted to start with the government's proposition that the burden is not lessened by charging attempted conspiracy, but I think it is. I think that's precisely the problem that we have. The doctrine of conspiracy has been undermined by the creation of this novel and co-ed offense, stacking them together. And again, it is, even with the government's explanation of what it should look like, it is confusing to go through the plea inquiry and try to decide what exactly the steps are for an attempted conspiracy. To return to waiver, the key principle, as this court has hit on, is the knowing and intelligent waiver of that right. The military judge starts the plea agreement inquiry by telling Airman Day, her counsel, and government counsel, who could have objected, that there are certain rights you never give up, to include jurisdiction and failure to state an offense. It requires presumption on presumption to assume that she knew all this and she understood it based on the surrounding circumstances. The plea agreement can't answer that either. The plea agreement is not explicit that she's giving up the failure to state an offense. If this was something that was negotiated over, as the government suggests, that would be easy enough to put in the plea agreement. All that it says is waivable under current legal precedent and public policy. And it references 705C1B, but all that section talks about is the rights that you give up. It's not specific motions you've given up, it's rights. And including in those rights are the right to due process. That's a pretty broad construction. The second point is whether this is waived by operation of law. But both the Supreme Court and this Court have recognized exceptions to the general rule, that's just a general rule, that an unconditional guilty plea waives all non-jurisdictional defects. The Supreme Court in Class in 2018, in fairly broad language, allowed for the challenge to the constitutionality of a statute in spite of the defendant entering an unconditional guilty plea. This Court has also recognized situations where in the Mizgala case that an Article 10 speedy trial motion is not waived despite an unconditional guilty plea if it's litigated at trial first. Also in the Pauling case, it's recognized that multiplicity is not waived if it's evident on the face of the specification. I think there's a parallel here where if we're correct that attempted conspiracy is not in fact an offense, it's evident from the face of the specification. It doesn't require a prejudice analysis of what actually happened at trial because, as the 11th Circuit said in Peter, when you have something that's a non-offense, it doesn't matter how much the proof, how overwhelming the government's proof is, it doesn't bring them any closer to convicting someone of something that's not actually an offense. And I think the key distinction that was hit on a little bit before is between what's merely a defective indictment or specification and something that actually states a non-offense. A defective indictment, something that omits wrongfully, or omits the quantity of drugs were necessary for a sentencing enhancing factor. That's a different class, something that can be cured by an analysis of what happened in the trial or during the plea, compared to a non-offense. That's not a curable issue for the court. And one final thing about charging TL, I believe he was chargeable as solicitation. In this case, there was another charge for SP that Aaron Day was alleged to have solicited him to have found someone else to kill TD. And went through the same analysis whereby SP would have been guilty as a principal or as a co-conspirator. And so if that theory is wrong, that you can't charge TL, it's problematic that it was used to charge a different specification for solicitation with SP. And I see my time is concluding.
Counsel, before you finish, yes, can you clarify for me the relief that you're seeking? You want the finding set aside and the charge dismissed. Where does that leave your client?
Well, Your Honor, we ask for the two specifications of attempted conspiracy to be set aside. But at that point, I think this court could affirm the remaining findings in the sentence. And this is distinct from many of this court's cases in the past, because now we have segmented sentencing where you can look at the entry of judgment and see that this is, in essence, harmless error for the purpose of the sentence. Because she received a 10-year sentence for attempted murder, a 10-year sentence for attempted conspiracy, and 8-year sentence for the second attempted conspiracy served concurrently. So setting aside those specifications has no ultimate effect on the sentence in the case. So it's kind of distinct from cases in the past where a specification is set aside and then a sentence rehearing is required. Here, I don't think that it is.
So your time has expired. Any further questions from the bench? Thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:40.